I thought that tonight I would let you fellas know that I know how to use this overhead projector. And so I have something that I want to show you. So if you'll ponder that a minute. Have you got it? Now, also, I'm going to write. I can write. And I would like to call to your attention tonight the fact that you have a number of responsibilities, and I'm riding piggyback on what we've said already this morning, having to do with managing your time and keeping your total life in perspective. Now, in order to illustrate to you what I mean, let me write some things down here. You are a man. You may be a husband. Perhaps you're a father. You are a son. You are on staff. How'd that come out? Now, let me ask you a few questions about this. If you were to rank those in the order of their importance, if I forced you to rank those, which one would you put first? How many of you would put the first one first? How many of you would put the last one first? How many of you would put the second one first? Well, there's certainly a diversity of opinion among us, isn't there? Now, I want to talk about these different relationships tonight because I believe this is very, very important as far as your own leadership is concerned. You are a man. Let me read you a few scripture verses that have to do with you as an individual. One time a lawyer came up to Jesus and he asked him this question, "Master, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" Now, if you were going to pick out one rule to live by, just one, which one would you pick? Do you have a sense of what is the greatest commandment in the law? Now, I should think that most of us would be willing and wanting to at least keep that one, if we're going to keep just one. And Jesus said in answer to that question, "Thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." Now, when I think that one over, and I try to evaluate whether I love the Lord with all my heart and all my soul and all my mind, I find it very difficult to grab onto that. Don't you? But he said that the second commandment is like the first one. And I don't see how. It doesn't add up to me, but Jesus said it was, and that's good enough for me. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is that I can understand the second one. Thou shalt love thy neighbor. Now that I can get. And that I can evaluate. Now, can you think of anybody in this room that you don't like? Can you think of somebody that gripes you, somebody that irritates you? Do you realize how serious that is? And when the Apostle Paul talks about us not letting the sun go down on our wrath, we realize what an important thing this is, that we keep our relationships clean on a basis of loving one another. Thou shalt love thy neighbor. How much? How much? As thyself. Now, I guess that's another way of saying you should love yourself. Now, this is Jesus speaking. I think that's what he means, is that I ought to love myself. And I ponder that a little bit. And I believe what it means is that if you're going to be relating yourself effectively to other people, you're going to need a sense of self-respect first. It's pretty difficult to be holding up a standard for somebody else to live up to that you aren't living up to yourself. It's difficult to be plugging for being a law-abiding citizen when you are not a law-abiding citizen. It's a difficult thing for a fellow to be talking about making room for his family life when you are not making room for your own family life. Do you follow me? Now, I have suggested this many, many times, and I want to suggest it to you, that tonight, when you... You're fading my shirt. When you go into your room tonight, would you sneak up to a mirror and look yourself in the eye and see if you can say honestly and sincerely, I love you? Try it. You know, some of you would be kidding yourselves. See if you can say this, I like what you said today. I like the way you said it. I like what you thought. I like the way you reacted to people. I like the objectives that you have in your mind. I just like you. I'm saying that this is important, that a man has a sense of self-respect. Now, one time, I was searching the scriptures, and I got this idea in my mind to ponder this subject of self-evaluation a little bit. Now, I'm not talking about morbid introspection. I'm just talking about a healthy kind of self-evaluation. You know, the kind that you observe in the athlete who runs out on the floor and just flexes his muscles just to make sure that everything is working right. And it isn't egotism for a man to say, boy, I feel great, I'm ready for the game to start. That kind of evaluation, that I'm ready, I'm prepared, I like my response to life. And as I look at the Word and I read the Word, I'm beginning to realize that my own life is being conformed to the Word. You know, I was talking to somebody here this week who was telling me something about his own assignments, and he said that I burned over that assignment for a whole year. Now, what a phony. Going around the campus, talking about victory, talking about joy, and resenting being there in the first place. Now that man, why did he come to me? He's a burdened man. And why? Because he's chipping away at his own self-respect. You know, across the years, I have had the privilege of talking with all kinds of full-time Christian workers who come to me after being in the work 5 years, 10 years, and they'll say something like this, "Hey, Doc, how do you get into your kind of business? I'm just not enjoying what I'm doing, and I want to get out of it." Now, I'm going around the country recommending to young men who come to me, and lots of them do, and say, "Doc, I would like to discuss with you how I can use my life the best in the affairs of men. And you know what my recommendation is? Go into the ministry. Some kind of a ministry. That's my recommendation." "Well, but don't you recommend studying psychology?" "No, sir, I recommend studying theology. I recommend that you become a real pro in what the Word of God has to say." "But isn't it true that you have the ministry that you have because you're a psychologist?" I say some of the stupid things I've ever heard have come from ungodly psychologists. It is not true that a Ph.D. or a Ph.D. or any other kind of a doctorate gives you the kind of a status that automatically guarantees you success. And if I have any kind of success at all, it's not that I have a Ph.D. In fact, I remember my first job very painfully. Very painfully. I was dean of men at a college. And they invited me to come to this college when I was still a student in that school, and they asked me if I would go and prepare for this job, and my Ph.D. program was in preparation for this job. I was the golden-haired boy around that school. And when I went to get my Ph.D., everything fell into place. Scholarships, fellowships, I got a Ph.D. just like nothing. And so here I am. I'm coming to the school now as the new dean of men. And I'm sitting in the president's office. Did you get that? The president's office. Me and the president and the dean. And we were deciding how we were going to run that school. Me and the president and the dean. Now, you can't beat that. I didn't know that there was a split in the faculty. I didn't even care whether there was a split in the faculty. We were making plans on how to run this school. Oh, I knew better than that. I knew. I was taught in my classes that I ought to be taking soundings from the students. I ought to be taking soundings from the faculty. But I didn't know that I had become so proud that my knowledge had gotten short-circuited. After all, if me and the president told me, "Go out and administer these things, Henry, and I'll back you up." Well, you know, we passed some rules. Half of the faculty didn't like half the rules, and the other half of the faculty didn't like the other half. You add that up. That's the whole faculty. And it's the faculty that influences the students. And before that year was up, I had the whole faculty and over 700 students mad at me before I woke up. And then I got mad at the president because he was leaving me out on a limb. I got a Ph.D. And I was a bitter Ph.D. A very bitter Ph.D. You know, there's a passage in the Scriptures, I ran into it during these days, and it made me mad when I read it. I don't know if that's ever been your reaction to the Scriptures, but this made me mad. Listen to this. This is Jesus Himself speaking. "I say unto you, love your enemies." 800 enemies. I'm supposed to love them. And here I am feeling sorry for myself. After all, I'm the guy that got the dirty deal. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. And that's what was happening to me. But you know, after a long period of struggle, I got to the place where I realized that this was true, that I needed to love my enemies. And I learned something. You know what I learned? That just because you get to love your enemies doesn't mean that your enemies are going to love you. And I figured that if I was going to love my enemies, that my enemies would just normally respond. You know what happened to me? I got fired. PhD and all. And I want to tell you that it is not a PhD that is going to make you an effective minister. What is it? It's going to be a man who has a sense of self-respect and who has in his mind a history of effective interaction with people, and he knows that he's being increasingly conformed to the image of Christ. And he's learning that he can take the nasty breaks, and he can take the problems of life, and he can take the difficult people of life. And he realizes that there is victory. I had an experience this winter. We went over to Haiti to minister to some people over there, and we were going to demonstrate what a layman's conference was like in Haiti. And Leroy Eager was our leader. And when we got there, the four law booklets hadn't arrived. The manuals hadn't arrived. We were expecting 50 missionaries, and there were only 15. And some of those were half asleep. And we realized that some of those weren't going to take the whole program. And there we were. And I looked at Leroy. And if ever Leroy and I had an opportunity and justification for being carnal, that was it. So what are we going to be? What determines what we are going to be? That problem? You know what that man's response was? We've got to have a miracle. So let's proceed to see the miracle. How about that? I say, that's growing up a little, wouldn't you? What an opportunity to pout and sulk and gripe and complain about crusade. You couldn't match it. But you know, I appreciated that. I thought that was real leadership. The fact that the first thing we're going to do is stop and evaluate our own response to a very difficult situation. And I want to tell you, brethren, we saw a miracle, and we saw several thousands of people in that poor land receive Jesus Christ. And I think we could have blown the whole thing if there had been a chink in our armor. Deuteronomy 4, and may I say before I go on, that one of the most important things that you're going to do as a leader is how you respond to those difficult, unexpected situations that pop up and will pop up unexpectedly. I remember this year in my business, I was telling you, we'd built a couple of buildings, empty buildings. Money was tight. We needed $160,000 and had no idea where we were going to get it. And I was sitting there with some of my men. And I simply committed it unto the Lord and went on to my business. The Lord was going to have to do this. I surely had no idea where that money was going to come from. And you know what my general manager said? Don't you care? Now, how does a man act that cares? Why, he's worried. He's upset. He at least ought to wring his hands. You ought to lose some sleep. You surely ought to pace the floor. Well, I want to tell you, those two businesses are in operation and they're booming, and there's only one possible way that they could have been in operation. It had to be a miracle. I'm saying that your example, and I appreciate this about our leader, and I have been involved in situations where I have been able to observe our leader, Bill Bright, in a crisis, lots of crises. Oh, I didn't say that we are always perfect around here, and I haven't seen him always being perfect, but as a rule, as a generalization, our leader knows how to tap the resources of God, doesn't he? And it's important, I believe, that the people under you realize that you know God and you know His power. So here's this verse, Deuteronomy 4:9. Only take heed unto yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen. You know, we take miracles for granted around here, don't we? And the next crisis that comes along, it's very easy for us, if you don't keep your soul diligently, the next crisis that comes along, it's going to be a very simple thing for you to forget what your eyes have seen. Lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. And I'm sure every one of you know some men who one day had the burden of the Lord burning on their hearts, and today it's departed from them, and they're cold and they're hard and they're bitter. And what he is saying here is, take heed unto yourself. And gentlemen, I want to say to you that you are a man, and never forget it, and you have to take care of yourself as a man. You need to keep yourself spiritually fit. 3 John, verse 2. Beloved, I wish above all things that you may prosper and be in health, even as your soul prospereth. I'm not saying, gentlemen, even if you are in a depressed mood, keep up looking like a Christian. We have a testimony. And even if you aren't one and you don't feel like one, for the sake of Campus Crusade, look like one. Sound like one. I'm not saying that. I'm saying at the point where that starts happening, our movement is going to start becoming a hollow shell. I pray that you may prosper, even as your soul prospers. You need to pay attention to yourself as a man. You know, one time I was reading a passage of Scripture, and it keeps coming to my mind, and I was thinking about you gentlemen tonight, and this has come to my mind. And I just want to remind you of this once again. Some of you have heard me say this, and I believe with all my heart that training involves repetition, and that repetition aids learning. 2 Peter chapter 3, starting with the 10th verse. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also and the works that are therein will be burned up. You know, that's something. That's going to be quite a day. I can just see Mr. Brenneman's sign company on that pile, burning away, neon lights popping. I can see Dickelman's warehouses on that pile. And then what's that bright flame? That's Leroy Eager's portalettes. Burning! What's that aroma? That's the meat out of my freezers.
burning.
And then there's that bluish light. What's that? Benefit swipe. And then over there, there's all that smoke. What's that? It's all those job descriptions you wrote. And all the four law booklets, and it's all going up in smoke, and it's going to go poof. Well, that's certainly not worth working for, is it? What a ridiculous thing to put your heart in that kind of stuff. I've always loved fire, and that's going to be a great day, isn't it? Now, why am I saying it? I said all of that to say this. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of person ought you to be? In all holy conversation and godliness. Gentlemen, make sure that you pay attention to yourself as a person. I believe that's the most important preparation you can make. Put your things into perspective. I had a startling experience one time. It was during the times when I was teaching at Trinity Seminary. And I used to leave once in a while on Sunday nights or Monday mornings. And this time I had a plane scheduled, but we were having company and the fellowship was so good, I decided I wasn't going to take the plane. I'd take a midnight train instead. And when I got off that train, and I got over there to where I was going, and everybody was so glad to see me, and I wondered, well, what's happened that everybody is so glad to see me? And they said, haven't you seen the headlines? And you know what the headlines said? Capital Airlines crashes. No survivors. And that was my plane. Have you ever had that kind of experience? I'll tell you, that was a hair-raising thing for me. Do you know, gentlemen, that I'm on borrowed time? Believe me, on my way home, I got to thinking, what am I going to do with the rest of my time? And I went home and I greeted my family and my wife. And do you know that my wife was pretty close to being a wealthy widow? Do you know what we did that day? That's the day I gave the Lord my wife. Do you know that in a twinkling of an eye, my wife could be through seeing me come home? And if that should happen, that's not the end of her life. My wife is still a person. Never forget it. I don't think that the world would come to an end if the Lord would snuff out my wife today. That's up to Him and He can have her. I love my three children very dearly, but that's the day I gave the Lord my three children. And that's the day my wife gave me away. And that's the day we were liberated. I'm just trying to say, gentlemen, that if you're going to be an effective leader, that you need to be able to love your neighbor no matter how obnoxious he is. How much? As yourself. I'm saying that the effective leader has a sense of self-respect. And I've had so many ministers come to me who want to get out of the ministry. Do you know why? Because after 5 years or 8 years or 10 years, you get kind of sick and tired of telling people that something can happen that is not happening to you. And it's a pretty empty thing to be telling a fellow how wonderful the peace of God is if you haven't got any. It's a pretty empty thing to be talking about the joy of the Lord when you're miserable. Now, there's another thing that I want to call to your attention. By the way, I wrote a little booklet called Balancing Your Marriage, and what I'm saying tonight is in that book. When I look around here and I think of the potential of all of you buying one of these books, Man, what a royalty that would be. So I'd appreciate it if you'd buy that. It will give you what I'm talking about here. I'm trying to point out that if you're married, you have the responsibility of being a husband. Now, that's not very profound, I admit. But I want to call your attention to your responsibility as a husband. And I feel that anybody that doesn't meet this responsibility is chipping away at his own self-respect. The husband is the head of the wife. Most of us like to quit right there. And we interpret that to mean that we would expect our wives to go along with any stupid idea we come up with. We like to interpret that to mean that our wives ought to put their minds into neutral and quit thinking. And I don't think it says that at all. In fact, I believe one of the best, one of the most useful evaluators that you have is your wife. She's got a big stake in this marriage. She's got a 50% interest in it, you know. And I know that as far as I'm concerned, when my family was growing up, the world's greatest expert on the subject of our children was my wife. Not me, but my wife. And I would have been pretty stupid to go ahead and make decisions about my children without consulting the world's greatest expert on the subject of those children. And the last thing that I would be qualified to do would be to come in off of a trip after being gone 2 or 3 weeks and start making decisions around the place. I wouldn't even think of doing that in my business. A man is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Now, just this thought, gentlemen. Jesus Christ came to this earth to minister to the church, to live for the church, to die for the church. Everything he did was in terms of the church. And if that's true, if I understand that, then a man's first responsibility is to his wife. Not the children, not crusade, not your business, your wife. Now you read that and see if that isn't so. Now you know there's a lot of brilliant people in this room, and you're smart enough, if you mean to strike a healthy balance between being a person and being a husband. Now, I don't know what that balance is going to be, but I do know this, that a wholesome man is going to take the trouble to see to it that he has a wholesome, healthy, effective relationship with his wife. Now, I've been around this place a long time, and I know something about some of your marriages. I have participated in some of the decisions that you have made. And some of you fellows know perfectly well that in the last years that you have neglected your wife. Now when you do it in the name of the ministry, that sounds real great. And when we say God first, crusade second, wife third, that sounds wonderful. But I don't know how you take those three apart. Do you? I am saying that you've got to interweave those. You know, there's not much use of us getting a whole bunch of people into my restaurant if we're going to feed them lousy food, because all we're doing is generating lousy publicity. Now, when you say if you had your choice and you were going to concentrate on filling your place with people or creating good food, which would you do? I say you can't take them apart. You can't separate them. You've got to do both. You've got to have quality food and people. You just can't take those apart. Now, there's no conflict, it seems to me, between what do I do with my time? Do I spend it on crusade, or do I spend it on my wife, or do I spend it on myself? I say you can't take it apart. But I'm saying that a wholesome man pays attention to his wife, and he keeps his wife right there in first place. Jesus, I believe the Word of God, the Apostle Paul, is saying that Jesus' relationship to the church is an illustration of your relationship to your wife. Now, I can't imagine any of us defending the idea of being bitter and hostile toward Jesus. I can't imagine any of us being mad at God. God, if you're up there, try and make me pray. And yet you might come home and flatly refuse to talk to your wife. Now, you know, we have a responsibility to balance our lives. Now, you take this matter of being a father. Let me give you an illustration of the difficulties that are involved. My wife and I, we really went out of our way to raise our children. And as I've said many times, I like this stage the best. Our kids are gone. Now, I don't say that because I didn't like the job. I'm saying it because every one of us who have children, there is the suspense involved in wondering how are these kids going to turn out. And by the way, while I think of it, I would like to ask you gentlemen to do something for me. I've helped some of you, and now I need your help too. I have a son. His name is Dr. Richard Brandt. He just got his PhD, and I can see him right where I was, not knowing how weak he was. He's on a faculty at Michigan State University in the education department. And I would like to ask all you fellas to pray for that fellow. He's got talent, he's got drive, he's got ability. But he's in that intellectual community. And he's being bombarded on all sides with different kinds of philosophies. And I would beg of you, gentlemen, to put that boy on your prayer list and to try and make friends of him and to draw him and to plant whatever seeds you can into his mind, because I covet that fellow for the Lord. Would you do that? He's got a tremendous potential, but like anybody else, in the intellectual community, you know what it's like. But we used to travel every summer for 5 years. We spent the whole summer together as a family. And this one summer, we just had an exceptionally good time. And we came home, and right after Labor Day, my wife and I went to Haiti for a month. He was 16 years old, and I was wanting to find out how much responsibility had I taught this fellow. So I said to him, here's the credit card, we're going to Haiti, we'll see you in a month. Well, I found out. He ran up about $80 worth of gasoline on that credit card in that month. He became arrogant. He was giving the lady that was in charge of our house a hard time. He was giving the people at church a hard time. And when we came home, he was impossible. After this wonderful, wonderful summer, this fellow just became impossible. He was nasty to me. He was nasty to his mother. He was giving everybody a hard time. And I had agreed to go over to the Holy Land to teach a sociology course for a semester. And by the way, you know who took my place? It was Howard Blandeau. But you know, it got closer and closer and closer to the date. And my son wasn't improving anyway, and it got to be November, and it got to be December. And I contacted Dr. Douglas, and I said to him, I'm awfully sorry to have to tell you this, and here's a real conflict, the perfect deal. I could get out of it. I could dump it in my wife's lap and take off for the Holy Land. And believe me, I was tempted to do it. I could have beat the daylights out of him. But if ever a 16-year-old boy needed a dad, it had to be that year. It didn't really make any difference who I was or what my responsibilities were. If that 16-year-old boy was going to have a dad and he needed one, it had to be then. And I had to do one of the most difficult things that I ever did, and that is to give up something I wanted to do more than anything else in the world, and that was to go to the Holy Land with that group of students. But my son needed me. I believe one of the most crucial strategic decisions I ever made on behalf of my children was to make that hard decision to put my responsibility as a father where it belonged. And for then, and I had to turn to some of my friends. And I had to say, fellas, you know, I'm having problems with my son. I can't get through to him. I can't communicate with him. I need your help. And one of my friends who had a big, powerful boat got my son involved in water skiing. Another one of my friends who was interested in deep sea diving, and he got my son interested in that kind of a thing. And do you know, I had to step back and I had to allow some of my friends to step in there and hold him up. And just as mysteriously as he became that way, he changed. Beats me if I understand it. But all I know is that when you have responsibilities as a husband, there's nobody's going to take your place. When you have responsibilities as a father, there's nobody to take your place. Now, any man who is a family man is going to, just like a businessman, is going to face difficulties and problems and crises. We won't be free of those, but the man who has a sense of self-respect is a man who can look back on saying, I placed my priorities where they were needed and I did not shirk my responsibility. And you cannot shirk your responsibility to maintain your own spiritual strength. You cannot shirk your responsibility to be the husband you ought to be, or to be the father that you ought to be, or the son that you ought to be, or the crusade member that you ought to be. Now, the point I was trying to make tonight, and then I'm going to quit, is that if you're going to be able to stand eyeball to eyeball to your men, and if you're going to be able to give your men a good, clean-cut, accurate, honest evaluation. I was just talking to a young man today who is on crusade staff who is finding it very difficult to get an honest evaluation from his leader. Now, if we have said anything, we have said that the people who report to you have a right to an honest, straightforward evaluation of your opinion of them. Who is the man that is going to be able to do that? The man who can stand eyeball to eyeball to another man and know that you love him. You know you love him. You're not a phony. And you've done your homework, and you are in a position to give him an evaluation, or you will make an effort to find someone who can. You haven't let your men down. You haven't let your kids down. You haven't let your wife down. You're a good, solid, loving, dependable, predictable gentleman. And that's the man who can step up to the mirror and look himself in the eye and say, I like you. And you say it with the realization that you've tapped a power that's not your own and that it pays off in the clutch. And I don't think there's anything that would tend to give you it would keep you up to date on your spiritual condition as being a leader of men. They'll expose your soul, won't they? And we need to pass that test. Now, I'd like to just call your attention once more to this booklet, Balancing Your Marriage. And there's another booklet here you might want to look at, You and Your Job. And then there's this one having to do with mental health, the struggle for peace. So if you want to ponder some of these things that I have printed, there they are. And I want to thank you, gentlemen. I can't think of any place in the world that I would rather be than right here. But now I'm going home, and I want you to pray for me because I'm going back to my business. Guess what? We got to decide what we're going to do next year. And what is the economy going to do next year? What are we to do? Are we to dig in and sit tight? Or should we launch out and expand? What are we to do? That's what we're going to talk about next week. And so I would appreciate your prayers. And I wish you would remember the rest of these businessmen around here too. Because when you realize that you have this facility and that hotel over there and that village down there, and when you think of all you fellows who are being backed up, believe me, you're being backed up by men who are out there in this rugged world having to make a profit. One last thought, and then I'm going to quit. I'm sorry, I forgot to turn that thing off. Gadgets. You know, I got to thinking yesterday, I told you this, didn't I? That I stand up here, and the number of people in this room is just about the number of employees that I have. 5 years ago, I didn't have any employees. Today, I have this many. You know the thought that occurred to me today? If I can attract that many people around me in 5 years, I'm sure you can. Did you ever multiply 350 by 30? You know what it comes out to? If every one of you fellows only attracted one-tenth of the people to you that I have, you know what that adds up to? A little over 10,000 people. That's what we're after. That seems so simple, doesn't it? I'm saying if I can do it, certainly you can do it. So I want to leave you with that challenge, that you ask God to show you how to become a magnet, that at least within a 5-year period, that you're going to attract a minimum of 30 men to help change the world. Isn't that exciting? God bless you. And believe me, I'll be praying for you. And don't forget to pray for me. Thank you.